world paused in uncertainty for a few moments today. It was just 10 minutes to six tonight when the news was given to the world that President Roosevelt had slept away. News that stunned and suspended in immobility for minutes the whole country, the whole world. Millions of men and women stopped stock still, unbelieving, when the news came. In many a home and restaurant here in the East, the evening meal went untouched, while an unbelieving citizenry tried to say it wasn't so. Veteran reporters at the White House wept unashamed. A cab driver said what was in many minds, "I wonder what will happen to us, what it will mean to us, I wonder." In a canteen at a far outpost in the Pacific, a young lieutenant came in, white-faced, to tell a group of sailors that the commander-in-chief was dead. The reaction was the reaction of the unbelieving world. They said, "It isn't so, it's a rumor." Yes, there was a pause of uncertainty throughout the world that knew Franklin Delano Roosevelt so well. The freedom of man had lost one of its staunchest champions. Fascism had lost one of its most implacable foes. It wasn't easy to take. For those few moments when the world learned, it was impossible to understand. But then, as men turned their faces once again to life, having looked on the face of death almost as if it were the death in the family, perhaps the first question that rose to most minds was, what shall we do now? The details were beginning to accumulate by that time. Mrs. Roosevelt had spoken in the quiet of the White House to Steve Early and Admiral McIntyre. She had spoken calmly, looking into the future as we all were at that moment. "I am more sorry for the people of the country and the world than I am for us," she said. And then she sent a message to her children, their sons on the far battlefields. "Your father slept away this afternoon. He did his job to the end, as he would have you do. Bless you all and all our love." Vice President Truman had come to the White House by that time, pale and shaken. He had gone in to see the First Lady, asking like a neighbor who loves, whether it be in Missouri or Maine or California or the East or the West or that which lies between. "What can I do?" the old question of the neighbor. And Mrs. Roosevelt had replied, "But tell us what we can do. Is there any way we can help you?" Well, here were familiar things coming up, the familiar tendernesses that tragedy brings among those of goodwill, the little things that were beginning to come to help the living to live on. I think we too shook ourselves then and repeated, "He did his job to the end as he would have you do. What can we do to help you?"
This is W.W. Chapman at Allied Supreme Headquarters in Paris. First news of President Roosevelt's death in the United States was conveyed to the American ambassador to France, Jefferson Caffery, by General de Gaulle personally. The leader of the French provisional government telephoned the American ambassador. He said that he just received the news by telephone direct from Washington. De Gaulle expressed his deep regret. And here's what Ambassador Caffery said. This is a quote. "I am shocked more than I can say," he said. "It's a terrible loss, not only for our country and for me personally, but for all humankind." At Ciro's fashionable nightclub in the heart of Paris, the master of ceremonies made the announcement as soon as he was informed of the news. The program was immediately interrupted. There was a minute of silence, and then the place was closed. That was general in Paris. GIs gathered as usual at the Red Cross Rainbow Corner in the heart of Paris. They wouldn't believe the news at first. They heard it indirectly by word of mouth, but then it was confirmed. MVs in their jeeps heard it over their radio sets on announcements from headquarters. All the men took the announcement pretty hard. "Gee," said one GI, "and he had to go before seeing a victory." This is W.W. Chapman returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
The National Broadcasting Company has rearranged its entire program schedule. All commercial programs have been canceled.
And here, ladies and gentlemen, in the NBC newsroom in New York, is once again Don Hollenbeck.
It seemed almost as if time and events must stand still in the stunning shock of this afternoon's news from Warm Springs, the death of President Roosevelt. As Will Hayes has just said, a war casualty as certainly as any soldier killed in battle. Of course, the news services have carried no other news since. But before the grievous blow fell this afternoon, events had been in the making that seemed to bring Franklin Delano Roosevelt's dream very near. High staff officers of our army told Senate leaders this afternoon that organized resistance in Germany would come to an end in a very few days. They were so sure of that fact that orders have already gone out to cut sharply the shipments of durable equipment to Europe. That statement, that decision, was probably one of the very last that President Roosevelt authorized as commander-in-chief. And Goebbels himself tonight, whose German radio sneered at Roosevelt even in death. Goebbels admitted that in his opinion, the war couldn't go on much longer. As Goebbels said, the German nation has sunk very low. How right he was. Probably the news had reached the president that our armies are in the home stretch for Berlin. Only this afternoon came the report that the 9th is well across the Elbe River and probably within 49 miles of the German capital, although a strict security blackout prevents the actual progress of the army from being told. Radio Paris said tonight that Allied parachute troops had landed at Brandenburg, only 20 miles from the German capital. But this, of course, is absolutely without official confirmation. And to the east, Moscow radio tonight reports savage fighting west of the Oder near Berlin. No doubt the concerted grand assault by all the Allies, the one good heave altogether to end the war in Europe. The 1st and 3rd armies are still rolling at the latest report about 15 miles from Leipzig. Weimar fell today. That news came early. Maybe the president had heard that the birthplace of the abortive German Republic in 1919 fell to the 80th Division without firing a shot. Direct defiance of Himmler's order just today that all German towns must be defended to the death.
Good evening. This is Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York. President Roosevelt is dead. Of course, you have already heard the tragic news. But it will take hours, days, for what happened at 4:35 p.m. today at Warm Springs, Georgia, to sink in. The tragedy of it is that Mr. Roosevelt did not live to see the final victory in this war, which he had had so much to do with bringing about, and the creation of a permanent peace organization, which he also dreamed so much of. But he did live to read bulletins this morning indicating that the final collapse of all organized resistance by the Nazis is only a matter of days. Mr. Roosevelt had been for 2 weeks at Warm Springs, the place he loved as much as any other spot in America, the place where he recovered from infantile paralysis, the place where, through his interest, thousands of others have recovered from infantile paralysis. During those 2 weeks, the president had attended closely to the affairs of state which weighed on him so heavily, but he was not well. He was well suntanned, but he was not well. Those who saw him the last few days say that he looked thin and haggard. Mrs. Roosevelt herself said that she thought that the president looked much too thin. For the past few days, he complained that food had no taste for him. For the past few days, he'd been eating only gruel. But today, he tried valiantly to go about his affairs. He spent the morning at his desk in the little white house at Warm Springs on top of Pine Mountain. At 1 o'clock, he was sitting for a portrait when he suddenly complained of a very severe headache. Commander Howard Bruin, a naval physician assigned to watch over the president, was called. He got there in a very few minutes. But the president was already unconscious, and he never did regain consciousness. He died in that little white house on top of a mountain at 4:35 p.m. Apparently, the two doctors were the only ones present when death came. The news was immediately telephoned to Washington. Mrs. Roosevelt's first words were these: "I am more sorry for the people of this country and of the world than I am for us." And then she sat down and wrote that simple little note to her four sons. And then she prepared to leave by plane for Warm Springs. It was a little after 5:45 p.m. when switchboard lights went on in the three press association offices in Washington. A voice said, "This is the White House. Hang on." There was silence for several moments, and then another voice said, "This is Steve Early." The president's secretary paused a moment, and then he said, "Flash, the president is dead." In a matter of instants, bells began to ring on news machines in every radio station and newspaper office in the country. And then, a story about today's triumphs of Allied military might in Europe was broken, and Steve Early's words were repeated, "Flash, the president is dead." Back in Washington, Vice President Truman was in his office on Capitol Hill when he got the news by phone. And the news that as soon as he took an oath of office, he would become the 32nd president of the United States. Incidentally, Mr. Truman took that oath of office about 15 minutes ago. When he got the news, his face went gray. He trembled for a moment, and then he jammed his hat over his head and rushed out. He didn't say where he was going, but he went directly to the White House. There, a little later, he announced, even before he took the oath of office, that he had asked President Roosevelt's cabinet to remain in office. He said he will attempt to carry on as he believed Mr. Roosevelt would have done. Incidentally, here's a bulletin. Let me interrupt myself. A bulletin from Washington. A bulletin which says that the State Department tonight announced that there will be no interruption of the San Francisco conference as a result of the death of President Roosevelt.
This is the NBC Newsroom in San Francisco. We bring you now NBC's noted news commentator and reporter of world affairs, Elmer Peterson.
Here in San Francisco, the news of the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to us in the middle of the afternoon. It caused workmen to pause in their tasks. It caused pedestrians to stop, their faces pale with the shocking import of the news. Everywhere there was the silent tribute to the passing of a great leader. Already you have heard that tribute expressed in words from various parts of this nation, from persons who know Mr. Roosevelt well. You have heard his life history reviewed, his achievements, the things he lived by, the things he worked for. Here in San Francisco, we have another thought as well. The thought of what the passing of President Roosevelt means for the future of the world and peace, the prevention of war. It is in this city, after all, that the United Nations shortly will gather to create an organization for world security. It was expected, it was a profound hope, that Mr. Roosevelt would be here for the opening of this conference, to endow it with his spirit, his confidence for the future. It would have been a great moment to have this man, who has guided us through war to the very verge of victory in Europe, to be present at a conference which was, after all, one of his hopes and aspirations. He would have come to San Francisco as one of the big three. He would have been identified with the great nations of the world. But his presence here would have been important also for the small nations of the world. In fact, as we reflect now with deep sorrow on the death of a great president, this coming conference here in San Francisco seems symbolic of what he stood for. The rights of the weak as well as the strong. The equality of all people. The striving to achieve a better world. Something else, too, in the sorrow here on the West Coast for these tragic news of today. That news comes as the war in Europe moves on to its victorious close. But here on the West Coast, we are constantly aware in our own way of that war yet to be won, the war against Japan. Here it is, after all, that we see the ships moving out to sea westward. Here we see the freed prisoners of war returning. Here we look out over the Pacific Ocean toward that great battleground where victory must still be achieved and where great problems for the future must be decided. A war and problems for which the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt was something to be relied upon. At this moment, those ships are still moving out to sea. The drive toward victory goes on. But the news that our wartime leader has passed away, yielding to a higher destiny than is ours to command, is a shadow over that war to the west. A shadow, too, over the conference at which the nations of this world, large and small, will strive for a new world.
Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt today sent a brief message to her four sons in the armed services, telling them that their father was dead. She said, "The president slipped away this afternoon. He did his job to the end, as he would want you to do. Bless you all, and all our love." And later, Mrs. Roosevelt added, "I am more sorry for the people of the country and the world than I am for us."
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the National Broadcasting Company takes you to Washington.
Take it.
Gentlemen, we're speaking to you directly from the press and radio room of the White House in Washington, D.C. The Honorable Harry S. Truman was sworn in this evening as President of the United States by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Harlan F. Stone, at exactly 9 minutes past 7 o'clock, about 2 minutes ago. Mr. Truman uttered the words, "I do," and became the 33rd President of the United States. The ceremony took place in the Cabinet Room of the White House, and attending that ceremony were members of the Cabinet and members of the Congress who had arrived here in the past hour and a half or so. As I told you, Harlan F. Stone administered the oath of office, and Harry S. Truman is now the 33rd President of the United States. Here in the press room of the White House, there are perhaps some 50 newsmen and radio men, all of them either working or running to telephones or trying to get to telephones to spread the news to the nation that about 2.5 minutes ago, Harry S. Truman became President of the United States, the 33rd President. At the present moment, there is no other vice president being elected to office or being assigned to office, and that office, as I understand it, will remain vacant for the president. And word has just reached me that Mr. and Mrs. Truman, I should say the President of the United States and his wife, have left the Cabinet Room, and they are now in the main part of the White House. It's interesting to note that Harry S. Truman came here tonight as vice president of the United States as a visitor. He is now making the White House his home.
Ladies and gentlemen, Cecil Brown.
Tonight, the grief of one widow in Washington is shared by people everywhere. When Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt was informed of the death of her husband, her first words were these. She said, "I am more sorry for the people of America and the world than I am for us." Mrs. Roosevelt must have said that because she well knew what her husband represented to the world. She put her grief second to the men, women, and children whose hopes and dreams of a better world were fixed on President Roosevelt. He was the father image for those Americans who recognize the real heritage of America, that is, those people who want to obey the instructions of the man who founded this country and said that all men are created equal and have certain inalienable rights. Not often does America have a president who, even at his death, even before history has a chance to pass judgment, can sit beside Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Wilson. President Roosevelt at once takes his position beside those other great presidents. And that is why tonight people everywhere are saying, "Why did he have to die when we need him so much?" Those who needed Mr. Roosevelt are the people who are fighting and striving to create a world of decency, justice, and equality. For President Roosevelt was the skillful champion of the men and women who are fighting to create the four freedoms. He had that vision, but what the world recognized also, he had the skill, the timing, and the personal characteristics which were helping to bring the four freedoms into practice. That is why Mrs. Roosevelt said, "I feel more sorry for the people of America and the world." Now, those people, steel workers, farmers, housewives, businessmen, soldiers, high school students, truck drivers, people in every economic group here in America and in dozens of other countries may well be wondering, who will be our crusader now for a better, more stable, more decent world? And also, they may well be asking themselves, will the progress President Roosevelt brought about now be frittered away? The new president, Harry S. Truman, remains to prove himself. He is under the great handicap of trying to fill the place of a man who, while he may not have been considered indispensable, was enough so that people are wondering who is to carry on an effective fight for a better, more democratic world. President Truman is a devoted disciple of the president. He saw eye to eye with him on foreign and domestic affairs. But of course, he does not have the experience that Roosevelt had. And whether he has the skill in high negotiations remains to be determined. On the record, Harry Truman's ideals and desires for more economic equality and world cooperation are the same as those of Franklin Roosevelt. But Mr. Roosevelt was an expert technician in the art of government. President Truman is about to be tested in that art. Mr. Roosevelt also bequeathed to the nation the concrete achievements of the past 12 years. Many of his domestic reforms are here to stay, not just because both the Democrat and Republican parties approve of them, but because the vast majority of the American citizens don't want to turn back to the days before Roosevelt. So perhaps above everything else, President Roosevelt gave the American people a chart, a map, showing a road to travel. It was bumpy in spots and still is, but it's evident that the American people have no wish to take detours or be so frightened of the bumps that we wish to turn back. President Truman, as the partner of Mr. Roosevelt, is going to continue America on that road. So people everywhere still have a crusader in the Roosevelt tradition. And now President Truman has the high duty to show his skill, his technique, and his effectiveness in reaching the Roosevelt objectives. He starts out at a time that has its advantages for him and the nation, and also pitfalls and dangers. Most important, he becomes commander-in-chief when victory is very near in Germany and when victory is inevitable in the Pacific. The military machines of the United Nations are running on all 12 and will continue to do so. Moreover, a tremendous start has been made on the machinery to preserve the peace afterwards, but only a start. And the machinery has been set up in part for the gradual reconversion of America's economy. But on the home front, very serious economic problems face the nation, just as they do abroad. The job of reconversion is one that is taxing all the ingenuity and skill of the officials of government, business, and the unions. The cooperation between those three groups has been rather good during the war, but the tensions are increasing as Germany goes down to defeat. The heat is being generated in Washington to ease up on many wartime controls, and the fight is growing sharper to break down many of the barriers to inflation. And now the champion defender of all has gone. On foreign affairs, it's to be expected that President Truman will take a time to gain an understanding of all the intricate issues. As you may have heard by now, Truman said that the World Security Conference at San Francisco will be held as scheduled, that is, on April 25th. Many other critical issues were facing Roosevelt in foreign affairs, and now they are in the hands of Truman. Some of the most urgent concern Russia. President Roosevelt stretched out a welcoming hand to Russia soon after he took office. And despite some gaps and deviations, Roosevelt's program of friendship for Russia ended up, as you all know, with Russia as our necessary partner in this war. The partnership is not all that it should be or even has to be. And President Truman has anything but an easy job to make it so. One of the immediate issues is to reach agreement on the new Polish government. Another is to reach final agreements on the treatment of the German people and the controls of Germany. In the Pacific theater, Moscow has removed the treaty barrier to the Russians joining in the war against Japan. But it may well be that Russian military and political strategy in the Pacific has not yet been integrated with our own and the British program. That integration may be one of President Truman's jobs. It will be when Russia goes to war against Japan. There is no shortage of grave issues facing the man who sits in the White House tonight. His sorrow at the death of his chief is great, but also great must be his sense of the high trust that Mr. Roosevelt, the American people, and the world are now putting in his hands. But President Truman has one advantage that stands above his own fervent hopes and personal integrity. And that advantage is that President Roosevelt created the organization and charted the free and inspiring road for America and the world to travel.
You have just heard Cecil Brown. Now, Charles Hodges.
The forthcoming conference on world security at San Francisco will test the power of a great man's idea. For President Roosevelt had doubled his stakes on post-war organization at San Francisco. He gambled on getting the United Nations to agree to the new setup, and he gambled on getting the United States to back it. The very core of his idea was and is the use of force against any nation threatening the peace of the world again. He knew that this underwriting of peace with military power, not words, is the boldest international proposal ever laid before the American people. Therefore, the very heart of Mr. Roosevelt's problem was to gain the assent of the Americans for the employment of this international force. This meant, and it means, gaining the assent of the Congress of the United States to military action in advance of war itself. It obviously changes the whole concept of a declaration of war. He wouldn't be waiting for a Pearl Harbor. He would be given the power to stop a Pearl Harbor before it starts. Congress really would be handing the president a blank check on his constitutional right to declare war under certain circumstances. President Roosevelt had made up his mind on this point. He had come to the conviction that there cannot be peace without giving the United Nations the means to maintain it. Therefore, he chose to commit this country, and he dedicated himself to leading the other nations of the world toward a policy of using preventive force, simply providing the international force of the United Nations to beat a disturber of world peace to the punch. He did this because he knew the nature of future warfare, its outbreak without warning, its instantaneous worldwide menace. President Roosevelt knew something else. How closely our world neighbors have been watching us. He had no illusions about Pollyanna wartime friendships. He knew that San Francisco posed a great problem for him. This problem tied up the international and the national politics of peace in a tight knot. Mr. Roosevelt certainly realized that unless the United States stood ready to use its war-made might for peace without debate, the other nations of the world wouldn't commit themselves either. His job, therefore, at San Francisco was to make the issue plain, both to our allies and to ourselves. This required, and it now requires more than ever, the assurance that the United States will accept this new obligation, not to meet force with eventual force, but to make post-war commitments for the creation of the United Nations power to enforce peace at once against war makers. President Roosevelt knew, as our new president knows, that Churchill and Stalin won't go along with the United Nations plan without full American participation. In this respect, it's the old League of Nations dilemma over again. Nothing will work in this world without the United States. President Roosevelt was a past master at shuttling back and forth between foreign and domestic issues, but he knew that at San Francisco, both angles were converging upon him. The security parley was to have been President Roosevelt's meeting with high destiny. All his powers of persuasion, national and international, were being mobilized. To his successor falls the task of making the San Francisco parley work. It is all that stands between us and that eventual next war. And it is important for you to remember one thing. President Roosevelt was a man who had real respect for President Truman. He knew that he could trust the new president to meet the onerous demands of this moment of American decision.
And now we bring you up and close a personal friend of President Truman speaking to you from Mutual Studios in Hollywood.
We'll have to get used to saying President Harry S. Truman. He's such an unassuming and likable chap. He's so nice even to those who have opposed him politically, as I have, that it's a little hard to think of him in the robes of honor of the chief executive of the land. And he won't mind if we think of him just as a fine fellow, a nice chap, and a good guy. But no matter who liked Harry Truman, and everybody liked him, or who did not like the thought of his being in the chief office of the land, and some of them did not like that, in this crisis, every American is heart and soul Harry Truman's friend. We couldn't be otherwise and be friends to ourselves as American citizens and friends to our country as the United States of America. And knowing Harry Truman, I know he feels friendly tonight to every American and appreciative of the friendship and support of every American. Never in the history of our country has a man gone into the presidency with so little animosity from any side at all. It's also true that never has a man gone into the White House with a wider experience and observation of American political customs, both good and bad, as well as experience in official procedures of our government. And all of this is quite aside from Mr. Truman's own ability, which it remains for him to prove with the utmost of sympathy and patriotic loyalty on the part of us, the citizens. Very difficult indeed have been the positions of men in our history who've been taken over, who have taken over office from a president who has died or been forced to leave office in the midst of a great crusade. We think of Andrew Johnson following the assassinated Abraham Lincoln, and Warren G. Harding following the Woodrow Wilson, who broke in the midst of his crusade for international peace. But Andrew Johnson took office in the midst of a great bitterness and was a bitter man himself. And Warren Harding inherited both partisan feuds and a growing public indifference to the efforts to establish international comity. There is a vast and comforting difference in the situation which President Harry S. Truman enters tonight. There is no bitterness in the man's soul, and there's no bitterness among any American group against him that I know of. And there's no indifference of our people tonight to the theme of ending wars through an international organization. The American people show their intense desire by their clamor for an organization based on justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Close. You have just heard a special series of comments prepared by Mr. Cecil Brown, Mr. Charles Hodges, and Mr. Upton Close. This program came to you from New York and Hollywood. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.